John chapter 6 says, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. John the Apostle, 90, 100 years old, writing, remembering, probably 15, 14, 16 years old when he was in the midst of this scene. Telling us that the Sea of Galilee is the Sea of Tiberias, for those who were reading as he wrote his gospel, because it named that for the Roman emperor. Telling us that Passover was a feast of the Jews, writing to the church, 189 AD. But somehow his heart is quickened, and he remembers this scene in a remarkable way. Now, the feeding of the 5,000 is where we are. It's the only miracle before the resurrection recorded in all four Gospels. And because it's recorded in all four Gospels, of course, the Lord is saying something to us. It says something to us of the impression that was made on Matthew, who was there, and John was there. But not only that, the impression that was made on, that gave first-hand accounts to Luke, as he wrote. The impression that Peter must have made on Mark. And it's still in Mark's heart as he wrote his gospel. The impression of this remarkable scene. Now, many lessons, no doubt. There are the things for us to see today that Jesus says when he begins to talk about the bread of life. And John uses this miracle of the loaves and the fishes to go to the bread of life. But only John does that. But certainly that was for then, and it is for now. Certainly the lesson for the religious Jews in the day, the testimony, because these crowds are going towards Jerusalem. It's the time of the Passover, and there was going to be a big stir in Jerusalem at the Passover, because there's 5,000 men plus women and children, between 10 and 15,000 that are eyewitness to this miracle and partakers of it, that bring this word to Jerusalem. So certainly there's a lesson there, again, for the religious leadership, for the people today. Certainly there's the basic need of the people that are hungry, that are out there far from, you know, they're 2,000 years and 7,000 miles from a McDonald's. And there's nothing for them to eat. They're out in a wilderness. And there's the compassion of the Lord and the great shepherd in feeding them. And I think that there is a lesson in the record itself, because Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't record the bread of life teaching. So just something in the scene for us also as we look at this miracle. But I think God is saying this is important enough that no matter what gospel you read, and if you only have one gospel, the early church, or if you're a missionary going to a field where only one gospel is translated, like many times in the mission field today, only the gospel of Luke is in a language, an indigenous language. I think God is saying, whatever gospel you read, I want you to see this. I want you to put this in your heart. I want you to learn the lessons that there are in this particular miracle. It was after the things that we read about in Jerusalem, the healing at the Pool of Bethesda, after these things, it says, Jesus says to his disciples, Mark tells us, let's go aside for a while. Let's go aside, go apart. He says that you might rest. Come apart for a while. One author said, if we don't come apart with Jesus, we'll just come apart. Rest. How nice. And when they rested in these days, there were no beepers, there were no cell phones, there were no fax machines. They really rested. These days, you can't escape, even when you try to rest. The crowds are there, it says, because they had seen the miracles that he did. They were eyewitness. And, by the way, it tells us that Jesus then heads off in the boat with his disciples to get alone for a while. They're going across the Sea of Galilee. When you're at the Sea of Galilee, you can basically see the perimeter of the Sea of Galilee. So the people, the masses, say they're saying, they went that away. So they're running around the northern end of the Sea of Galilee to beat them over to the area that they're headed to. And when Jesus arrives on the shore with the guys, they must be rowing, thinking, oh, it's so nice, we'll get away for a while. Club Med, you know, we'll have a weekend off or something. They get there, there's 5,000 men plus women and children waiting for them when they come on shore there. Well, they're going to learn about a different kind of rest by the end of this day. They might be griping in the beginning. You know these days. I thought I was going to have a day off. I thought I was going to have a day alone. I thought I wasn't going to have to do this today. But by the end of this day, I'm sure that none of these disciples would have traded it away for what had happened in their life. Jesus heads up into the mountain. He teaches these multitudes, and he heals many of them, we're told, in the other Gospels. Large crowd. Springtime, beautiful, sitting in the fields. When Jesus saw, verse 5 it says, when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw the great company coming to him. Now, the other gospel tells us before he could say anything, the disciples said, send them away. Oh, that's amazing that God can do anything with us, isn't it? And these were the apostles. Send them away, Lord. It's late, you know. Send them away. You didn't bring your sundial. We thought we'd let you know what time it is. They give Jesus all kinds of wonderful information. Send them away. Well, when Jesus saw this great company come to him, he said to Philip. I'm not sure why he picked out Philip. When we get to heaven, you can ask him. Said to Philip. Probably because Philip was very pragmatic and had that kind of, you know, Judas is handling the money, but Philip must have been businesslike or something. He says to Philip, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. So the thing that worries me about this is Hebrew tells us Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Which means that he has the right to, in my life, and I hope in your life too, so I'm not alone in this, put us in an impossible situation beyond our resources, knowing already what he's going to do, to make us squirm? No. I think to let us work through, you know, we immediately go to those mental gymnastics. Want to do this? And others, you know, how much money? And Philip, why don't you take care of feeding them? And Jesus is just watching. He already knows what he's going to do. Just kind of watching Philip, watching his wheels turn. Jesus created him. He appreciates his ability, wired him, you know, knows exactly what he's doing, he's going through. He's got the math going in his head. Jesus knowing that he's in a situation that's way beyond anything he's able to deal with. And Philip gives him the answer. Well, cha-ching, cha-ching, it comes up. Philip answered him, well, 200 pennyworth. Now, a pennyworth was a day's wage. So 8 months' worth of wages is insufficient to buy bread that every one of them could even take a little bit. Lord, this is what we figure. We pull everything together and we use 8 months' wages. We don't even have enough to buy everybody a crumb. No way to pull this off. And that's exactly where Jesus wants to bring them to. You know, you may have had that kind of day. One of his disciples, Andrew, who evidently is like Simon Peter, he's his brother, happens to say things out loud. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said unto him, there is a lad here which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. He can see all the other guys turn around and look at him. And you see there's a colon there, so you know there's a pause of time before he says, everybody's looking at him, then he says, but what are these among so many? So he must have thought initially, everybody turned around and looked at him, you know, 5 small barley loaves are like little pita breads, they're small. And 2 sardines. 15,000 people. we don't have enough money to buy it. Philip figured it out, but we do have 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fishes. And he must be thinking, I can't believe I said that. I can imagine the other guys are looking at him. Because then he throws in, but what are they among so many? Now, that's the point of the lesson. But, because that's what we do. When the Holy Spirit challenges us to step out in faith in a situation beyond our resources, we immediately turn to our mental gymnastics and oftentimes, I'll speak for myself, turn away from the prompting of the Spirit. But what are they among so many? All I got is a slingshot. What does that mean to a giant? All I got is a jawbone of a donkey. What's that got to do with 1,000 Philistines? All I have to do is, I only have this stick. What's that have to do with parting the Red Sea? All I have is a clay pot and a torch and a trumpet. What's that have to do with the 135,000 Amalekites? There's all of those buts through the Bible. But what are these among so many? Many times, same God orchestrating similar circumstance. But what are they among so many? Now, I thank God as I look at the scene that there's a kid involved. Because, and I imagine he's not a 14-year-old, because he'd have been smart enough to say, I ain't pulling my lunch out in front of this crowd. This is a kid. This is 5, 6 years old. This is some kid that pulled out his lunch and said, hey, I got 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes if anybody wants to share. And this kid in the morning, when Jesus is going across the boat in the lake and everybody's running around the lake, said, there he is over there. And the kid starts running out of the house and his mom said, where are you going? Brush your hair. Did you brush your teeth? Wash your hands. The master, the healer, everybody's going. I'm going. They'll just, here's a PBJ, you know. Take a lunch. Little did that mother think that she was going to feed 15,000 people that day. Thank God for some faithful mom giving this kid a sack lunch. Thank God for the childlikeness of someone to pull that out in the midst of an unimaginable need and say, I've got this. I don't know why Andrew said it. We have 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. I don't know what he was thinking. And evidently by the response and the pause there, everybody's staring at him, and then he said, we came to a census, but what are these among so many? Now this is the point that Matthew tells us, who was there, who was an eyewitness, when Jesus looked at them and says, give them to me. Give them to me. Central. Key. Give them to me. The lesson, certainly. Look in verse 10. Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in this place. It's springtime. One of the other gospels tells us it's green. So that the men sat down in number about 5,000. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. They don't know who's standing in their midst. And Jesus took the loaves. Look at verse 11. When he had given thanks, what it says is, Jesus says, make them all sit down. I think it's Mark that tells us that they sat them, Jesus said, in companies of 50s and 100s. So there's order here. And you can imagine these 12 disciples, because please remember, they never read this chapter. They're arriving at this scene for the first time. Why is he making us do this? I don't know. Just listen to him. I don't know. Everybody sit down. The people are saying, why do we have to sit down? Because the master said so. They don't have any idea why. They're organizing this thousands, you know, over 10,000 people sitting down in groups now, 50s and hundreds. Is he going to give them little Bible studies with little sermonettes? What's this about? You know, just, and they got them all sitting down. And then it says Jesus takes the bread and the fishes and gives thanks. What it says is, you know, imagine the 12 guys come back. Is everybody, yeah, everybody's sitting down. Takes the little barley loaves and the two sardines, and he looks up to heaven and he says, God is great, God is good, and we thank him for this. He says grace. Now, the disciples never read this chapter. Imagine Jesus saying grace over five barley loaves and two sardines and 15,000 hungry people looking up at the top of the hill saying, what are they doing? Jesus is saying grace. And I don't know, what are they thinking? He's going to have to break them in itty bitty pieces. What are they thinking? You start to get the idea of why this is recorded in all four Gospels. Barley loaves. Small fishes. It doesn't say loaves and fishes. We hear of the miracle of the loaves and fishes. It's barley loaves. Why does God tell us that? Does he know how much we're into bread? Barley loaves. Small fishes. You know, it's not like French bread and smoked salmon. Barley loaves. That was the most meager of the bread in that day. The poor people had barley. People with any money or substance ate wheat bread, pita. Barley was a sign of the poorness of the family. God is saying something to us about the most meager of things that we would bring and put into his hands. The things that maybe society would look down on and frown upon, that Jesus might actually say to you and I, give them to me. And I mean, what do you do when you look at the things around you that are overwhelming? I mean, here we live in a city of millions of people. And you drive down 95, and you look out across Philadelphia, and you see row home after row home after row home after row home after row home. Millions of people. You see steeples and crosses all over, and you think, yet the city is so unchurched. It's so dead. And you think, what can I do? I'm one person. I didn't go to seminary. I didn't go to Bible school. You know, all I really have is a burden to serve in Sunday school. All I really have a burden to do is to stand on the corner and hand out tracts. I have six kids. All I can do is survive every day. Try to teach them about the Lord. These are barley loaves. They're meager. They're contemptible. In the eyes of people that want to work with real substance. And the answer is the same. Give them to me. Lord, how can I ever accomplish anything? Here's my heart, Lord. And Lord, my heart is insincere. I know it's right to serve you. I know it's right to be more sold out than I am. Lord, what can I do? And the answer is the same. He never changes. Bring it hither to me, he says. Give it to me. Give me your insincerity. Give me your broken heart. Give me your meager attempts to serve me. Give me your insufficiency. Give me the ridiculousness, the absurdity of five barley loaves and two sardines in front of starving masses. Put it in my hand. Now, I'll tell you this. He'll work with what we have if we give him all of what we have, no matter how meager it is. He won't work with what we have if we're trying to give him half of what we have. You have to understand, Jesus doesn't need anybody to get his work done. But he will use anyone who will obey. If you will give him all that you have. This little boy gave all that he had. If you'll give him all that you have. He's not looking for people that are qualified. He's looking for people that are available. Lord, this is all I have. It's contemptible in the eyes of many. Give it to me. Put it into my hands. He took the loaves, and when he gave thanks, he distributed them to the disciples. And this describes a disciple's responsibility. And the disciples then distributed them to the people that were set down. We're just distributors. We're not producers. We're distributors. It's the other Gospels. You read the Gospels combined, the miracles taking place. I know what the laws of science say, that mass or matter can neither be annihilated or created. Jesus don't care about that. The Gospels clearly tell us that as he's breaking the loaf, continually the loaf is just growing in his hand, reproducing. We'd love to do that with a steak sandwich, wouldn't you? Just break it off, just keep it coming. That as he's breaking the fish, it just keeps coming. There's a miracle of creation taking place. Now imagine the 12 guys. They're going back up to the top of the hill, filling up a basket and going out, giving it to 50s, giving it to 100. Imagine them passing each other in the aisles they made, saying, do you believe this one? I thought the healing at the Pool of Bethesda was something. This is really something. What's he doing now? I don't know. I hope this keeps up because the people down there ain't getting on you. They look real hungry. They're going to start a riot if it runs out. Just imagine the scene. Imagine what's being impressed on their minds. He broke. The miracle is taking place in his hand. Distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to those that were seated. And likewise, of the fishes, and I like this, as much as they would. Seconds, thirds, fourths, whatever group you were in, a 50 or 100, as long as you kept saying, Peter, waiter, over here, more fish, more bread, it kept coming. That's what it says. It says in verse 12, when they were filled, there's time that's gone by, and the word is glutted. That's when you go to the restaurant and you've sinned and you can't breathe anymore, and then your stomach has pushed your diaphragm up against your lungs, and even if you want to laugh, you have to go real little laughs, and then you hyperventilate, and everybody's giddy, and you're thinking you're sweating. I wish I was home with my sweatpants on. I have to loosen my belt without everybody seeing me. Everybody was glutted. They're all leaning back on, you know. That's the scene. As much as they would. That's how he gives. That's how he provides. 15,000 people from 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, as much as they would. It kept coming and coming and coming until they were stuffed. Nobody was sitting around thinking, yeah, I'd like to have one more piece of that, but I'm not going to ask. 14,000 people in front of me in line. As much as they would. Now look at verse 12. Interesting. When they were filled, and he, Jesus, said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain. King James says that nothing be lost. Some of your translations say that there be no waste. Isn't it interesting? Just because Jesus multiplies in a miraculous way doesn't mean we have to be good steward over the things that he gives. He says, gather up the fragments. Now, there's another lesson. There's a reason why. Gather up the fragments that nothing be lost. And they're going to find out he means nothing of the food, but nothing of the lesson. That nothing be lost. Therefore, they gathered them together, and they filled 12 baskets with the fragments of 5 barley loaves, Mark tells us, and fishes, which remained over and above unto them that had eaten. So he sends them out to gather up the fragments of the fish and of the loaves. Each guy comes back with his own basket. There's not 13 baskets. Jesus had already said to them, I have meat to eat that you know not of. There's 12 baskets. end of the day. We hear here the sun's going down. Beautiful in the Sea of Galilee. People are all sitting around stuffed. And now he's got his 12 disciples standing around him. Each one of them has their own basket filled with fish and bread. And imagine what it was like for them to eat that day. At the end of that day, as they sat down and they looked at him. They watched him. Like John the Apostle tells us, that which we have seen, that which we have listened to, that which we have handled in the Word of Life, that's what we want to communicate to you. Imagine looking in Jesus' face that day. No wonder it's written in all four Gospels. Each man with his own basket. Oh, they had said earlier, send them away, Lord. Let us rest. But I'm sure that the rest that they had in their heart at the end of the day was much greater than the rest they would have had just getting away from people. Because they've seen something that would change all their lives. Very important. Because he's going to send them out. He's going to be crucified. He's going to rise and he's going to ascend. And he's going to send them out to talk about the kingdom to the world. It's very important for this to be in their hearts as they go. Very important for it to be in our hearts. Whatever burden you have for a particular ministry, whatever overwhelming situation you face, however meager you feel your own personal resources might be in light of the need that's in front of you, you need to listen carefully and see if you hear his voice saying, bring them to me. Put them in my hands. Let me show you what they really are. Let me teach you about this shepherd's staff that will bring the greatest nation in the world to its knees, that will turn the Nile River to blood, that will part the Red Sea. Do you know it? Or do you know it so well you don't know it at all? Let me tell you about the slingshot that you use to chase away jackals. And it's a giant killer. You know that? Let me tell you about what the people think so little of, but that I have carefully taken years to put into your hands. Give it to me so I can show you what it really is. Remarkable scene, remarkable day. It never left them, and John, as an old, old man, relives this day as though he was there, the Holy Spirit inspiring him and giving this record to us. Verse 14 says, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth that prophet from Deuteronomy 18 that should come into the world. They're no doubt equating it with the manna. They're thinking, this is the one. This is the one Moses spoke of. And in their mind, no doubt looking to him as Messiah. Now, it says this in verse 15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again into a mountain by himself. Matthew and Mark tell us that he, first of all, constrained the disciples to get into a boat and sent them to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He himself dispersed the crowds and went into the mountain to pray. Now, he will not receive their loyalty on the basis of bread. He's not Grandpa Stroman. You know, this guy can make bread. He can make food. He can be our king. I'll tell you, that's America today. That's the world today. That's how the Antichrist is going to come to power. Jesus said, I came in my Father's name, you didn't receive me. Another's coming in his own name, and him you will receive. He's going to have the answers to the world's problems. Look how this nation is willing to throw morals to the wind for the sake of their pocketbook. Jesus is going to say to him later in this chapter, you're not following me because you realize the miracle. You're just coming because you ate the bread. And he won't receive their allegiance. He won't receive their loyalty. He won't let them build on the foundation of material gain. And he's going to show these disciples that he's not the bread king. He's the storm king. Because when you follow out the lives of these men, all of them will have to know that in the midst of the storm, that they're right where Jesus wants them. Matthew will be skinned alive. Andrew will be shot full of arrows and crucified. Peter will be crucified upside down. Thomas will be impaled in India. You read through their lives and you see what happened to them. And if their whole life and relationship to God was based on prosperity, based on material gain, then what happens when that God doesn't show up in a difficult situation? Your faith falls to the ground, because Jesus said the storms will come, the rain's going to come, the wind will blow. Then those who have built their house upon the rock, upon Jesus, Savior, Lord, risen, returning, will endure the difficulties of this life. Building on sand is not going to produce anything. You know, we sit here, we live in the American illusion. I live in it, you live in it. I mean, how many times do our kids go to the refrigerator, open up, stand there, running up the electric bill? There's nothing to eat. It's because they can't see past all the food. There's nothing to eat. You know, if you've been in the third world, you feel like putting them in a box and sending them. Nothing to eat. What do you think is in a refrigerator? Marbles? What's in there? Or stand at their closet. I don't have anything to wear. I sit in a room full of video games and skateboards and toys, and I'm bored. Cut the grass if you're bored. I'll give you something to do. We have a consumer mentality. We have a whole nation that has a mentality of a 13-year-old. I'm bummed out because I didn't get this. I'm bummed out because I didn't get that. I'm bummed out. I want one of these. I saw this one. Oh, see that new thing? Oh, see that advertisement? Oh, you see that? And our whole happiness is based on, are we getting? And we want that kind of king. The bread king. The belly king. And Jesus knows that his disciples are safer in a storm than standing on the ground with the wrong concept of who he is. And believe me, there's plenty of that poison in the church today. Jesus saw what was happening. He constrains. It means he argued with his disciples. They were saying, come on, they're going to make you king. What's the problem? So we get in the boat. Shut up. Get in the boat. Shut up. Pushing the boat off. You know, get out of here. Go over there. You know. And he had to send the crowds away. And he himself goes up onto a mountain alone to pray. I need to remember that all the time. If Jesus needed to pray, guess who else does? You. No, me. If the Son of God needed to pray, how I need to pray. And when evening was now come, his disciples went down into the sea. They're on their way across, by the way, in obedience. Jesus put them in the boat and made them go out. And entered into a ship and went over the sea towards Capernaum. It was now dark. Jesus was not come to them. Ever have that feeling? The sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, we're told this is the fourth watch. It's between 3 and 6 in the morning. They have been rowing since dusk. To between 3 and 6 in the morning, they have been rowing for 9 to 11 hours. They are in the midst of the sea. They're only halfway across because it says the wind is contrary. A huge storm comes up. The Sea of Galilee is about 600 foot below sea level. You've been there. There's a huge gorge that comes down by the Arbel, by Magdala, and the wind falls down. The cold air from the Mediterranean Sea falls down. And I've got pictures of the Sea of Galilee at home with 15 foot waves on it. Now you have to understand, this is Storm 102. They've already taken Storm 101. In Storm 101, Jesus says to us, let's go over to the other side. Not let's go under to the other side. Let's go over to the other side. And he gets in a boat with us. We get into a storm and our life feels like it's falling apart. And it says he's sleeping in the back of the boat. Been there? In a storm, Jesus is sleeping? But at least he was in the boat with them, so they could wake him up and tell him he was about to die. And complain first. Don't you care? The kingdom of God's going down, and you're sleeping. Are they in God's permissive will? Are they in his perfect will? Oh, please. They were in the midst of the storm and in the midst of his will. He said, and was in the boat with them, let's get in the boat and go to the other side. Oh, I hate storms. Some of them are mandatory courses and not electives. I don't want to major in that. Whatever it is, Lord, can I drop this course? Can I take a correspondence course? But if you've walked with the Lord for any length of time, you know there are times that you find yourself... And then we examine ourselves. Is this because of sin? Is it because of this? Is God getting... No, he's right there with you, sleeping in the boat. He told you to go. You're right where you're supposed to be, in a storm. Storm 101. They woke him up. He said, oh, ye of little faith, why are you afraid? Rebuke the wind and the sea. It stopped. It said they were more afraid of the calm than they were of the storm. They all went, who is this guy that even the wind and the sea obey him? And the Psalms told them, we go down to the sea in ships. The seas of the waves of the sea rage, but the Lord rebukes them. He makes the storm a calm. Told them right in the Psalms. They knew those Psalms. Now, this is Storm 102. This is when Jesus sends you into the storm alone. He stays back, goes up on the mountain. He's praying. You're 3.5 miles away in the dark. It's overcast because there's a storm, even though it's full moon. So you ain't even going to see yourself die. No street lights, no neon lights. Now the remarkable thing is Mark tells us that Jesus was on the mountain praying and he saw them. He was watching them. As today he ever liveth and maketh intercession for the saints. Whatever storm we're in, he's on the mountain, he's watching, he's praying for us. It's the same yesterday, today, and forever. They were not out of his view. 3.5 miles away in the pitch black overcast, Jesus, his eyes have no problem at all transgressing that distance, crossing that, having a perfectly clear view of us through the darkest night. From miles away, from an unimaginable distance. It says in Mark that he was watching them. Now imagine that. I wish he wouldn't do that. If he looks the first time and sees me in trouble, come rescue me. You don't have to pray for 9 more hours. Just come. He prays. These guys are out in the boat. I'm sure their hands are blistered and bleeding. I'm sure that their quads, their legs are cramped up. Pain in their back, cramps in their forearms, rowing and rowing, rowing between 9 and 12 hours straight. And he's watching. He's watching them. They're in the midst of the sea. They're in the midst of his will, the Lord. the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed, it says in Mark, he saw them toiling for hours, about 25 or 30 furlongs. That's about 3.5 miles, about halfway across. They saw Jesus walking on the sea, drawing nigh to the ship. They were afraid. The other gospel said they started to scream because they thought it was a ghost. Because they, you know, storm 101, he's in the boat with you. It's storm 102 when he walks across the sea. So imagine these guys rowing. They're looking back. They're facing backwards. They're rowing this way. They're looking back. They've been rowing for hours. By now I'm saying, I want to die. Just let the water come into the boat. My body hurts so bad, I'll just breathe the water in. I'm ready. There's no sharks here. I can drown in this lake. There's no problem. Jesus comes walking down off the mountain and heads out across the lake. What, did anybody see that? Any villager looking out his window see this guy in a robe come walking down and just head across the water, head across the storm? Mark tells us he made as though he would have gone by. Now you have to understand, this is pitch black. So these guys are rowing. They're looking back. Once in a while there's lightning. Lights up the lake a little bit. See something? What is that? That's funny. Look, it must have been the foam on top of a wave. You see that? You know, and now as the lightning, he's getting closer. Now the guys are going, they're all screaming. That's what the Bible tells us. They think it's a ghost coming out. We're gone. We must be dead already. We're laughing. Put you out in a car somewhere, broken down on the side of the road, you know. So, you know, go to one of those campfires and listen to anybody tell about, oh, they heard scratching on the side of the car. They pulled away. They found a hook hanging on the side of the car. You know, we don't much spooky. Don't give me that like you're some kind of brave, you know, you're a brave guy. They put you out in a lake in a pitch black, no street lights, scared to death, feel like you're going to die and see some ghost come walking across the water. You're going to be screaming too. Don't laugh at these guys. I've lived this thing in my mind. I can see it. Rowing, the lightning, all they're seeing. What does it mean that he made like he would have gone by? Is he in the passing lane? What is that? How can he just walk? You know, these guys are for 9 hours, they're rowing, and he walks to the boat like he would have gone by? What does Mark mean? When we go to heaven, we need to say, Mark, why didn't you explain? What does that mean? He made like he would have gone by. They're screaming. He answers their fear. They're not afraid of the storm now. They're afraid of the ghost walking across the water. That's what it says. He says, it is I. Be not afraid. Ego am I. What he says is, I am. What the burning bush said to Moses. This is the God who just did an act of creation with the loaves and fishes. Now he doesn't care about the laws of gravity either. What they hear him say is, I am. Be not afraid. Now, the most remarkable thing, and it's in Matthew. Mark, who wrote, no doubt under Peter's tutelage, skips the story. Peter probably said, please don't write that. Matthew tells us, Peter said, if that's you... Peter, have you had bad experience with people passing you in the lake and storms in the past? What do you mean, if that's you? If that's you, bid me to come to you on the water. This is not a good idea for a guy whose name is changed to Stone. Maybe he's tired of rowing. I don't know. If that's you, what is he thinking? He's never read the chapter either. He's never read the chapter. If that's you, bid me to come to you on the water. Jesus says, come. Peter, it says, climbs down out of the boat. Decent-sized boat. Climbs down out of the boat. Does it mean, does he touch it first? The water? He gets out of the boat and he walks on the water. Now, it's dark. They've got to be close enough that the other guys are seeing this. And they're learning something about obeying their master. That though they're just humans, imperfect, like you and I, whether it's loaves and fishes, whether it's a storm, that there comes a time in our lives when the Lord bids us to get out of the boat and walk on the water. human beings can't walk on water. You know, this year in Israel, because they expected it to be a big hubbub there, you know, year 2000, and the Catholic Church, the Pope said he would give indulgences to anybody who visited the Holy Land this year. So they built extra hotels. The Israelis are good business. And on the Sea of Galilee, they built a plexiglass walkway about an inch underneath the water so that tourists could come and walk out onto the Sea of Galilee, and your relatives could take a picture of you walking on the Sea of Galilee. It's true. Jesus says to Peter, come to me. Peter gets out of the boat, walks on the water. Now, imagine the other guys are not rowing now. They're sitting there with their mouths hanging up. They probably said to Peter, no. Storm 101 is rebuke the wind and the sea, not tell me get out of the boat and walk on the water. What is he prolonging this for? And Peter gets out and walks to the Lord. And then it says, you know the story, he beholds the sea, the wind boisterous, the storm. And he gets his eyes off Jesus, onto the storm. He begins to sink, and he cries out. How far down did he go? It says Jesus caught him by the hand and pulled him back to the boat. Was just half his body sticking out of the water, Jesus taking him back to the boat? Just the scene is incredible. He takes Peter back to the boat. John says, then, verse 21... they willingly received him into the ship. And immediately, the ship was at the land where they were going. They covered 3.5 miles at the speed of light, or faster. Storm 102. Our real destination is in the boat with Jesus. Storm 102, real lesson is that he's in the storm with us. We are where we want to be. Imagine this, because Matthew tells us at this moment the wind stopped. When Jesus stepped into the boat, the wind stopped, and it says immediately the bow crunched up on land. They traveled 3.5 miles when Jesus stepped in the boat. The wind stopped, the storm's over, they're at shore, they're sitting there with bloody hands, sore backs, blisters, dripping, looking at him. And it says they came and worshipped him and said, truly, you are the Son of God. First time they say that. They took hold of him and they said, truly, you are the Son of God. Much more important lesson than just taking someone and making them king because they can put food in your belly. I don't need a bread king in my life. I need a storm king. Because life is filled with storms. And we're all going to experience them. They come in a lot of different ways. Remember watching, and it's interesting, Joshua, when he was 4.5, bleeding to death in front of us, racing to the hospital, blood all over the inside of our van. My wife screaming, praying in tongues, telling me to drive faster. I'm going 90 miles an hour driving through red lights. I'm thinking, we're all going to be in heaven. But looking at him, and in my mind at that point, being certain that he was dead, that he was, that was the end. But all of a sudden, the thought of what the gospel was all about flooded over me. I'm going to see him again. This is not goodbye. This is see you later. What this is all about is death and resurrection, forgiveness of sin. Getting to the trauma unit and running in, covered with blood. He's all white and blue. His lips are blue. And, you know, when you come in, there's a nurse saying, do you have medical insurance? Could I see your paperwork? And, of course, I'm supposed to act like a pastor then or a Christian. You're going to need to take care of him. I'll give you the information, Tino. And it's just one of our men that I love, a doctor, happened to be there that night. The head of running the trauma unit. After I was rude enough, came up and said, I saw in your paperwork, they were stabilizing Josh. Calvary Chapel, Philadelphia. That's the place up there, yeah. Oh, my wife was on your women's retreat. She really enjoyed it. Let's pray. Well, then I could say, okay, Lord, you're in the boat with us. I don't know why you're letting us be in the storm. I know, Lord, that you had a son named Joshua that you gave for us. And you had the power to stop this whole process. Lord, I'm helpless. But it's enough for me to know that you're in the boat with us, that you're involved. And storms come in marriages, in relationships, in raising children, as we watch our parents pass away, hopefully to go home and be with the Lord, as we get older. And we get our own reports from the doctors and the specialists. And somewhere, someday, we face a storm alone, came into the world alone. We go out of the world alone. And there's that great storm of death. It comes to all of us. But we worship the God of storms, who walks on top of the water, takes us by the hand, who rebukes the wind and the sea and takes us through and steps right through to the other side into heaven. And when he gets in the boat with us, the bow crunches right up on the shore. And that's who we worship. Now look, I'm not teaching this because I have this lesson nailed down. I'm still going to scream in storms. Lord, why? I'm Pastor Joe. Remember me. I serve you. How can you let this? Is bad for your reputation to let things like this happen to me. But we grow in grace and the knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, and these things become deeper. They become more real. And we find ourselves in circumstances that unbelievers disintegrate in. Because there is no hand to take hold of them, to lift them up. There is no one there to walk above the waters and rebuke the wind and the sea. Loaves and fishes. Storms. I think he still speaks to us. I think he still has things to say to us by his Holy Spirit. I'm going to have the musicians come and we'll sing one last song. I encourage you, as we do, you just lift your heart to him and say, Lord, so, you know, because I'm sure there are people right here in storms tonight. I'm sure there are people here who want to serve tonight who feel all I have is barley loaves. I have the most meager of, you know, gifts or talents or resources to bring, Lord. They're not even worthy to be recognized in light of the tremendous need that surrounds us. Look, that's why he tells us these things. It's not dependent upon your resources, it's dependent upon his.